Welcome to Divergent Paths, the podcast. I'm the host, Dan Dunford, and thanks for listening in today. Really excited about today's episode. I recorded this back right before Easter, back in March, when the members of this ensemble were all in town before they headed out for a tour. The episode this week is with the wonderful brass ensemble, the Westerlies, four guys from Seattle who are just an absolute pleasure to talk to. That is Riley, Zubin, Andy, and Willem. And it's a little bit of a funny story behind this one. I talk about on the episode, I talk about like when I first heard of the Westerlies and listened to their music for the first time. But the youngest member of the group, his name's Willem de Kock, and he plays trombone. And he's the youngest, and he recently graduated from Manhattan School of Music. And I went to see the Westerlies perform at Barbez, which is a venue here in the city out in Brooklyn. And I'm sitting there waiting for their concert to begin. I'm ready for the concert, just like ready to go. And I see the four guys up there, and one of them walks over to me. He's like, "Hey, it's Dan, right?" And I'm really taken aback because I didn't think any of them knew who I was. And it turns out that he wasn't one of my teacher's, regular students. He worked with my old teacher, Dave Taylor, while I was still a student at Manus. And I had met him before one of my lessons. And, it was literally 30 minutes of me listening and enjoying the concert, but also wondering, and I finally pulled out the memory of meeting him, and felt really awkward about it. And what better place to put my awkwardness than at the beginning of my podcast and right before an interview with these guys. But I sat down with the Westerlies, and it was just a really good talk, really fun one, and we got into some really cool stuff. And these guys are doing some really, really great music, and really great ensemble. If you aren't familiar with them, you should make yourself familiar with them, and it will be worth your time. I've a couple of their tracks from their last album featured on this episode. Both these tracks are from the album entitled "Wish the Children Would Come On Home," the music of Wayne Horvitz, who, as you'll find out in the in my talk with them, was a mentor to these guys and a really great musician. Before and kind of underneath the beginning of the interview is a tune called "The Store, The Campfire," and at the end is the title track, "I Wish the Children Would Come On Home." Really beautiful pieces from a really great ensemble. They have a lot of stuff coming up in the summer here in the city. So to get on board with what they're doing, go check out westerliesmusic.com. And the Westerlies is Westerlies, I guess like it sounds. Westerliesmusic.com. They're on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, everything, SoundCloud. So check them out, and I really hope you enjoy this interview, because I had a really great time recording it. And if you like the episode, hop over to iTunes or Stitcher or whatever and hit subscribe, leave a review. That's helpful to me. I always welcome feedback. Send me an email at divergentpathspod@gmail.com. Share it around to people you think might be interested. But talk to you guys next week.
Thank you.
Yeah, no holds barred on this. You gotta like complain about each other and shit. So that's good. Really sow seeds of discord. all right. Well, first, thanks so much for doing this. I know this is kind of your 1 week in New York, so it's a little bit busy and crazy. But I really appreciate it. So we have the Westerlies, and we'll go like left to my right. You know, so we can get like whose voice is whose. Mm-hmm. So.
Andy.
He plays trombone.
I am Zubin. I play trumpet.
I'm Willem. I also play trombone.
And I'm Riley, and I play trumpet.
Great. That's... you guys kind of first came to my attention. I'm not like some like guy sitting on his throne being like, oh, this group. But if I'm not mistaken, you guys did some stuff for the Harlem Creates Music Festival last summer, and it popped up. A friend of mine was working the festival, and he had posted some pictures, and I was like, oh, the Westerlies. I was like, what is this? You know, I clicked on it. I was like, this is a brass quartet that I have no knowledge of. What is going on? And I was just kind of like, this guy's, you know, I like kind of looked through the Facebook, I looked to your website, I was like, oh, and listened to some of the stuff. I was like, oh, this is really cool. And then last month, it was like, oh, last chance to see them before they go out west. And I was like, well, I have to do it. I have to at least like go out there and like see if I can like talk to them a little bit. It worked out nicely. So you guys just did a month-long tour on the West Coast. Hitting up California and up into Washington as well. Yes. Yeah.
Kind of the opposite direction. but same general idea. We started in Seattle and worked our way down to San Diego and then back.
So obviously you guys were all from Seattle. So how did the kind of the origins of the thing start? I mean, like, obviously, I'm sure you have one guy who's usually talks about the origins.
this is a trick we can all do.
I'll field the question this time. The four of us all grew up in Seattle together. In fact, Riley and Zubin lived about two blocks away from each other all through their childhood. And then
it's like a solid four and a half.
Okay, four and a half blocks, my mistake. And the three of us ended up going to the same middle school and high school, a few years apart from each other. But we all played in school jazz band and that kind of thing together. And Andy went to the big rival high school uptown. So we would see Andy at jazz festivals and high school jazz competitions. And so throughout high school, we were sort of aware of each other's existence and occasionally did some projects outside of school together. But one by one, we all ended up moving out to New York for school. Zubin was the first, and he and I went to Manhattan School, and Riley and Andy went to Juilliard, and we all found ourselves in New York, just spending a lot of time together, probably because we shared this common history in Seattle. And one day, I thought it might be cool for the four of us to get together and try playing some music, just the four of us. So we all brought in a couple of original tunes and arrangements of things, none of which we're currently playing. So everything in that first rehearsal got scrapped.
We found the recording recently, yeah, actually.
Oh, man. How'd that feel?
Well, it was so weird because there is some music out there for two trumpets and two trombones, but we didn't know where it was or what it was.
And a lot of it is not good.
We're not allowed to say that.
Okay, I'm just like, here's the, like, with Easter coming up, there's a lot of churches who do two trumpet, two trombone stuff, and then there's a library of things that normally get played. I'm not gonna say who the arranger is, but
we're actually doing.
It's just the same. It's just like 20 pieces from the same, you know, 20 plus pieces by the same arrangers from the same time period. Two trumpets, two trombones.
What time period is that?
That's like it's like 1650 to 1780.
Right, but arrangements that were done in like 1980,
yeah,
85.
And it's just...
Well, the funny thing is that now we're actually doing our first ever Easter gig as the Westerlies this Sunday. and we're playing some of this kind of world of music, mm-hmm. and we're like, oh man, this is so fun and different. Like,
that's fair.
No, but then
that's
but fair. Then actually the church music director wrote us an email and she was like, oh, I think you guys misunderstood. Can you just play originals instead?
So, oh, right. She wanted us fun. After yeah. we've been like working our asses off on Gabrielli yeah. for the last hour.
Yeah. Learn how to play in tune and articulate yeah. things the right way.
Anyway, I'm sorry, I interrupted you.
That's
so
okay.
you're talking about the concept of not there not being quite as much two trumpet trombone stuff.
Right.
Because it's not as much of a standard setup.
So we all brought in maybe like a sketch or two that was originals and then some songs that we liked, just trying out how we could improvise around them. And then we also did a lot of just free improvisation.
Mm-hmm.
But it was tough, and it was tough for years, just playing in tune. Like, we often say that it took, like, over a year to learn how to play in tune. I mean, we're still working
on
it.
At least, yeah.
But it was really, really tough. But I think we had some great mentors and community around us that sort of, I think their belief in us and what we were trying to do sort of convinced us that it was worth it, because based on those first few rehearsals, it was like, you know, if we hadn't had people being like, whoa, this is cool and different.
Yeah. And I think the kind of interesting to me thing about it looking back is how much we started from scratch.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't come at it with any sense that this was similar to, I don't know, any kind of outside reference. Like, I think Willem was probably the only one with actual chamber music experience. The rest of us, like, we're much more used to playing in jazz quartets with, like, you know, rhythm section. And so I think we really started from scratch, just mm-hmm. like, okay, there's four of us and we play similar sounding instruments, and what can we do with that? I think because of that, it took us much, much longer to get to a point where it felt comfortable.
Mm-hmm.
But because of that extra time and that extra challenge, I think it makes it a little more unique.
Well, sure. I mean, and living in New York, like, there's literally dozens, if not hundreds. Every brass player plays in a quintet. And generally the idea is to earn a little extra cash. Like, whether if you're outside of school where you have to play in a quintet for your grade, but, like, you know, it's playing wedding tunes and like events, and just there's nothing wrong with going out with the idea of making money. There's no problem with that. But a lot of times, and I've played with a few quintets, and I even like tried, you know, putting together my own, and it's hard to find a group of people who are interested in pursuing a more artistic direction, because that doesn't, you know, if you set up something where you just want to make a little bit of money, you can do that pretty quickly, mm-hmm. comparatively. But if you're shooting for an artistic direction, it just takes longer. Like you just said, it took a year to figure out how to play in tune, like, really, you know, and really adapt to each other's kind of playing styles, and every person has kind of a unique intonation. Like, that just takes time,
mm-hmm.
and a lot of people don't want to put in the time because there's so many things that, you know, so many distractions and such.
Yeah.
Well, I think the thing that is really special about this group is that it really was formed just based on friendship,
mm-hmm.
and common interest and a common background, and we would have come together regardless of what instruments we played.
Right.
It just was a coincidence that it was a brass quartet.
Yeah.
And I think that connection and that friendship is really an asset that we feel very fortunate
mm-hmm.
to have found. And
yeah,
is what keeps us together and keeps us driven to pursue this direction.
I mean, if you're like on a base level, if there's friendship there, like, you can handle getting pissed off at each other and like fighting a bit, and then you have that friendship and you're like, okay, you know,
just
Andy's a good guy, like, we'll get through this. Or,
just,
you know,
means
whatever.
The fights are more direct when you're friends. Like, if it's just professional acquaintance, then you bite your tongue. When you're friends, you're like, dude, are you serious?
Well, then that's just it. Like, with a professional acquaintance, you might bite your tongue, and that can start to, like, you push it down, and it starts to fester a little bit, and mm-hmm. then, like, And when it does finally explode, you're just like screaming at each other, and then everything falls apart.
Right. And then you just like hire another guy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which that's a whole other thing.
Yeah. Right. Well, we've talked about how in formation and in like core organization, I guess, we're sort of more of a rock band, just in terms of it came out of friendship, it came out of us writing our own music, like doing some covers and then like writing our own stuff, much more than anything connected to classical or jazz, because we weren't like getting together to play the music of a composer, we weren't getting together to play tunes. So yeah, it's interesting that to me at least that we kind of fell into that format. Not that any of us had any history of playing in rock bands either.
I think we all dabbled in garage rock bands in middle school.
We actually realized that all of us like casually double on electric bass in our own rooms. So eventually we're going to do a show called The Electric Bass Drillies, and we're going to play arrangements of all of our
music exactly the same, just on electric bass.
Well, I mean, just from a stereotypical point of view, with four guys from Seattle, it'd be stranger if the four of you hadn't dabbled in garage rock in middle school. Yeah. Like, we're talking, what, early 2000s? Yeah. Like, I mean, like... That would have been really
done my share of Green Day covers.
And Nirvana, come on, Seattle history.
It's all coming out.
Yeah, it's all coming out. You're not actually a musician. It's not.
Like that concludes this interview,
and we're done. Awesome. So you know, when you're kind of starting out from the idea that yes, this is kind of, you're coming at it from a different angle. I mean. Not a whole lot of chamber experience, not, you know, a setup that's not particularly used in chamber music original compositionally, from an original composition standpoint. What was that first kind of like 6 months, you know, what was the goal and the aim there?
I think a large part of it was just figuring out what are the elements we need to construct an interesting set of music, just from a bare bones structural perspective. Having come from somewhat of a jazz background or playing with orchestras and whatnot, this was a very kind of naked setting for us to be making music in. And so figuring out what are the elements we need rhythmically, harmonically, melodically, texturally, to construct an interesting body of music, and we're still trying to figure that out.
It's super important. Like even, I mean, not to name names, but like any, like a lot of professional groups and solo artists or people who are doing solo recitals from an orchestra, or even orchestras for that matter. Like you look at these concert setups and it's just not that interesting. Like you're looking at like a lack of understanding of how to construct an interesting concert program. You're like, I'm just going to do these pieces because I'm good and I can. Like, well, there's more to it than that. You know, it's a something I think about regularly.
Yeah, and I think everything is interesting to someone.
That's true.
Like, just to sort of like advocate for the other side a little bit.
Yeah.
That it is still wonderful to hear the masterworks played perfectly. But yeah, it does feel like a lot of the classical established world is in a bit of a state of panic right now, of trying to figure out how to reach younger audiences, how to like come up with creative ideas to expand their base and like you said, try more creative programming. A lot of it's super awesome. I don't know. Andy was at the armory last night, and there was a herd of sheep in the piece. but I don't know.
I had a friend who was involved in that, I think.
Yes. Yeah. Unbelievable.
Yeah. A flock of sheep, not a herd.
Herd.
A herd of
herd of goats.
A herd of goats, a flock of sheep.
Is it a flock of sheep?
Yeah, the shepherd's
flock.
It's
a flock of sheep.
Okay, flock.
Yeah. excuse me.
To continue on that, note about challenges. I think something we came to realize fairly early on is that a lot of our limitations as brass players can also be our biggest assets, and like accepting those limitations and trying to exploit them in musical ways to just create some honest form of expression was something that we kind of had to figure out, because there are so many limitations as brass instrument. The timbre is pretty much homogenous across trumpets and trombones, so how do you create a varied range of textures?
And the endurance, like, more than anything, playing a set of music continues to kill us, but in those first few concerts, like, having the horn on your face for an hour with maybe a measure here or there of rest, but nothing more than that, just absolutely made you want to jump off a cliff and never play music again.
Yeah. That's actually something...
It gets physically painful, and it took so much building endurance, figuring out how we can structure the music to make it playable.
Right.
How we incorporate, how we write for each other, because we get to know what each person needs and what each person can and can't do. And then there are also moments where things don't work, but then, like, Zubin, at the time we were early on, was going through some embouchure stuff, and was able to, like, make these sounds and this the sort of way of playing that even now, when maybe his playing is in a totally different place, but that element and those sounds are still a part of our repertoire, part of our, like, sonic vocabulary, because we found them at that time in that place. And there are all these things like that where there are moments of time where we stumble upon something, and it may come from, like, failing to attempt to get through brass music, because with brass music a lot of funky sounds come out, you know.
Yeah.
But now we have little words to recall each of those types of sonic things, and we bring them into the music all the time.
Well, now you have to tell me what some of the words are.
There's the flute.
The flute. The moon.
Moon. Scream of anguish.
Wah.
Maybe that's just inside my own head.
The wahs.
Westerly woo.
Westerly's woo.
That's when we're like, woo.
The soup.
What is it?
Tonal soup.
Yeah. Or modal soup.
Modal soup.
That's
atonal soup.
We got a lot of soups.
Yeah. I got a lentil soup. It works over
there. It's really good for you.
Dan, I know you studied with Dave Taylor, and I worked with him a lot. He was my chamber music coach in school for a while, and then I took private lessons with him, and he always would reiterate this point. He would always say, weakness creates style. I don't know if he ever talked with you about that.
Obviously, it's funny that you bring that up, because I did a big 2-part interview with him that I just released over the, you know, last Monday and this,
oh, cool,
this Monday.
I'll check that out.
2 days ago. And it's funny, like a guy like him will be very, you know, in a lesson situation or in a coaching, he'll be pretty upfront about, like, what his limitations are and how he overcomes them. And it's an interesting thing, because a lot of times you have beaten into you that anything less than absolute perfection, whether you're playing Mahler 5 or Bolero. What's the trombone excerpt? I don't play that.
You got it. That'll do just fine.
It's the one.
Or like a play, you know, pieces like that. In a situation, you know, if you're in a situation, an audition situation or whatever, if you don't play it perfectly, you're out.
Right.
You know, unless you have some huge body of work recommending you. Like,
right.
You have to. And so when you come across these weaknesses that, or what some people view as weaknesses or failures, like being able to take those and put them into your art, you know, it's a much more like modern art way to look at things, as opposed to a traditional classical or or even jazz sense, you know, mm-hmm. like the same, it's interesting, and it's same in some ways in the trad jazz world, like you want to play these changes perfectly, mm-hmm. and like meld them in perfectly and play these licks, these shout licks perfectly, but there's more to it than that, you know. Anyway, that's my digression.
No, yeah, it makes a lot of sense. I feel pretty specifically rebellious about the kind of conservatory idea that you need to become virtuosic at every style, and then after you do that, you should start to develop your own voice.
I've had that told to me in many low brass studio class.
Yeah,
it's which, like no, play the crescendos and articulations on the page, and then down the road, then you can add your own stuff. I'm like, but I have stuff now.
Yeah,
right.
And it's amazing to do that. But I mean, like we're talking about, I do think that your own difficulties or inadequacies, I guess, can really be where your personal style comes from, and that can maybe be more interesting to listen to than like total mastery.
And you can, you know, figure it out. Like it allows you space to figure stuff out. Mm-hmm. Like what I'm saying might not be that great, but at least I'm like trying something new, kind of a thing.
Yeah.
I had that told to me by, again, bring up David Taylor. I'd play something in my lesson and he'd be like, I don't like it, but I see what you're saying.
Yeah.
Which is I wouldn't do that, and I don't know how I feel about it, but yeah, you're saying something.
I mean, just philosophically, that's like one of the best things you can say to a person, I think, in any situation, to be like, I disagree and I don't like this, but I respect you doing it and I see it and I hear it, you know.
It makes you think more about what you're saying too. Mm-hmm. Like it's a lot more of, it can be really frustrating because it's not something you can pinpoint, like, what am I saying with this piece of music? It's more amorphous. There's not something you can necessarily grab and put into a 3-minute lesson sized box. Kind of a thing. Anyway, so as you guys have developed as a group now, how many years have you guys been playing together?
4 years.
Comes up on 4.5.
Yeah. November of 2011 was our first rehearsal.
Wow. So it was like right. Wait. Was it right after you got here? It was like
You guys got together. Yeah. It was like 2 or 3 months into my freshman year. Yeah.
That's.
Willem came to New York chock full of steam. As they say.
Do they say that?
About Willem, they do.
That's pretty rare. Like, it's pretty rare for like people in school to put together something like that. Sometimes it takes a little bit longer, just from like time constraint. You know, at least from what I've heard, especially at Juilliard, it's a lot more rigid about how you can do your things outside of the giant glass castle.
Literally. It was a really nice escape.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we all had very, what's the word? We all went through experiences at our respective schools where an escape was really valued, and to be able to come together and hang out and play music. We were hanging out anyways, whether we were mm-hmm. listening to music. We would eat dinner every Sunday night at Zubin's apartment with a whole bunch of other Seattle friends, and so it was really nice in that way, because whatever extra time you have that you want to get away from classroom, from all the work and obligations you have, you're hanging out with your friends from your hometown. But also, I think it very much was not like, we didn't see this becoming such a thing when we were, you know, getting together. It wasn't like, here's this new project.
Yeah.
It was just, we're like trying some things out. Mm-hmm. And there were all these like steps along the way where it still wasn't, then it was like, okay, so this is fun, so we'll do a couple shows. Like, we'll do a house show and this and that. And then it was like, oh, that was fun, we'll do we'll try to book a show at a New York club so mm-hmm. more people can come see us. But it very much was not seen as this thing we're taking on in addition to school, which is this exciting new performing brass project. You
that
know?
Kind of a label because
that would have that would have been way too daunting to try to think of starting a starting a career that's gonna be like a big part of your life while you're still in school would have been like no way. I would have said like too much.
Yeah. Riley almost did. I remember specifically like we had just recorded one of our we had tried to actually record a piece that to like release on SoundCloud or something, and we set up mics and Riley and I were listening to it, and he says something like, I mean, I'm just not sure anyone would really want to listen to this.
What piece was it, do you remember?
This might have been...
Was it Commencement?
Were we in Cape Cod?
No, we were in Cape Cod, yeah. It was Proof. It was a recording we did of Proof.
Yeah. It says, okay, it was a piece by Andy, says sorry, nothing Andy. About the composition.
It's a great piece.
Great piece. Great piece. But, I mean, it was hard. It was hard to play in tune. It was hard to create difference of textures. Like, there was a lot of soup. There was a lot of... And I remember just hearing it being like, wow, who's going to put this on?
Right, because it was sort of a moment of like, well, we're definitely having fun, but would our audience, you know, or would this, is this some kind of, is this like sort of in the experimental music category where it's mostly for the performers?
Right. So that's why I think I said earlier that it was because there was some support and excitement from our community and from some mentors of ours that... like we did our first show at a club in Seattle called the Royal Room, which is owned and opened by Wayne Horvitz, who's this great mm-hmm. composer who we love, and we ended up playing his music. And after that show, which was like all these ups and downs, our first time playing in front of everyone, there were some train wrecks, there were some things that were really cool.
Just sweating bullets the entire time.
It was like the first time we tried to get through a set of music, so physically it was like so painful. A lot of sweat, maybe some tears. And Wayne was like, oh, this is so cool, like, this is going places, like this is so exciting. And we were like wiped out and
angry.
Angry.
Never again.
But that was like, it was very validating and exciting. And then we ended up playing a whole record of his music, and we played the Royal Room every time we go to Seattle.
I think in a lot of ways, him asking us to make a record of his music was one of the first real like validations. Just, oh man. Wayne, you know, he always felt like this guy on this other level, guy who lived in Seattle, who spent his formative years in New York and kind of represented this whole upper echelon all over the place today, but of music. And I think that made us kind of step up our, I don't know if ambition would be the right word, but at least sort of view it as a more significant thing.
And the work that we had to do to just get that music together and learn how to play it in tune and record it, I think really brought us together.
Right.
Just in terms of time and commitment to the project. And after we had done that work, then we had this whole body of music that we knew by heart and we could go out and play. Mm-hmm. And that seemed to really resonate with a lot of different communities. Which was exciting.
Yeah, it's great. I mean,
it's funny that you would say that. Oh, who would want to listen to it? Because the first time I was listening to it, I was like, well, this is not what I've been bred to expect from a brass ensemble. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, it's the first, you know, the high quality brass playing, but just it's like enjoyable, you know, and to a layman. It doesn't have to be like music nerd listening to access it and access the emotions behind it.
Well, you weren't listening to that first recording. That might be
right.
We got some stuff for the nerds.
But doesn't everyone? I mean, to be completely honest.
Totally.
God, I have some things that I've recorded where like it was like an hour of music and all that I could pull out of it for that I was really. You know, I was proud of the whole thing, but all I could pull out of it was like 3 minutes. Like one 3 minute clip where I was like, everything came together on this 3 minutes.
Right.
And, you know, and I was really happy with that 3 minutes, but the rest of it was just so much work. I was just like, oh my God.
Isn't recording a crazy thing? I mean, it's so revealing.
Yeah. It's kind of the worst, but also really great.
Right, it's so important, but yeah, also terrifying.
Yeah, even God, even just me, like I have to listen to my voice every week when I'm editing these things, and I'm just like, God, my voice is the worst.
But I think we're also, speaking of that, I think we're lucky in that both Zubin and Andy do a lot of recording and production and stuff, so it, not all young bands and groups, when they're mm-hmm. trying things out, have the opportunity to record mm-hmm. as often as we did, just to listen back and check it out and see what we liked and see what we didn't like. We recorded a lot of pieces that we were working on. We didn't always put it out, you know, mm-hmm. on the internet.
Right, just as part of the rehearsal process.
Yeah, mm-hmm. we would record and listen. And
so how did you guys kind of settle into the body of work that you began performing regularly? I realized that, like, the first, you know, your first album was all of the music by Wayne. And then the album that will be coming out is all your original pieces by each member of the group. Mm-hmm. But how did you kind of, you know, I'm assuming that you play other stuff as well, not just the things from those two, past project, upcoming project. Like, how did you kind of settle into, like, this is our body of work that we play regularly, and how do you bring in new stuff that's not composed by you guys? Mm. That's a really wide-ranging question.
I would say it's a pretty organic process. I mean, we started off playing our own music and then took this detour to do the music of Wayne Horvitz for that project and tour that for about a year and a half. And then once that cycle had kind of completed, we really wanted to go back to our roots of playing original music and put our own voices out there, mm-hmm. both as composers and players. And so some of the music on that second album we had been playing almost all along, but we were also really excited at the opportunity to write new music, having discovered all these new sounds and textures and having gotten to know each other's playing even more so. So we kind of have had this tradition the past few years of going out to this island outside of Seattle called Lopez Island and spending time workshopping and composing new music. So we spent 2 weeks last summer out there with a keyboard upstairs and then a little rehearsal set up downstairs, and we would just take turns writing, coming down, trying stuff out for 2 weeks. And a lot of the music for this new project was created during that very intensive
that seems like it would be super intense.
We sleep in 4 bunk beds
stacked on top of each other.
No internet, no phone service.
Oh man.
We're really in it together.
Well, there's a lot of guys who have done that and it worked. You know, a lot of that's kind of like a more like rock band way to look at coming up with stuff. And Sun Ra did it as well.
Yeah.
But like rock bands will go out into the middle of nowhere, no service, and we spend 2 weeks writing or recording, whichever, and just like do it.
Yeah, and it's luxurious. It's challenging, but it's also, I mean, especially from the composing perspective, mm-hmm. to be able to write something, then immediately hear it played by the instruments, not only the instruments, but the instrumentalists who will be performing it, is huge. I mean, you don't get that even in the best composition programs in the country, like that many readings.
You don't have to have that interim of Sibelius or Finale, MIDI instruments.
Yeah. And like, I don't know, I don't consider myself a super skilled composer in terms of like writing something and being able to hear it, or like mm-hmm. writing orchestration and being able to imagine it, but it lets you really rely on trial and error more than coming at it from a more, I don't know, academic approach of just like writing it and imagining it. So yeah, super nice.
So do all 4 of you have compositional backgrounds at all? Or, you know, is it just kind of a thing that grew out of the necessity and desire for music for the group?
Andy definitely has the most in terms of prolific and education background in composing. And Andy was composing some serious stuff when we were still in high school. So we first, I know Willem and I would go up to his house in North Seattle and play some of his music. And towards the end of high school, or even in some concerts that he presented, some bands that he was putting together, we all had sort of different backgrounds. I don't write a whole lot, but did more once I got to Juilliard and once I got to college. Just to speak, I need to speak.
Yeah. I mean, same for me. I wrote a couple little experiments in high school, but then, yeah, it's not, I don't compose on a regular basis and I don't have any academic background in it, so it sort of just evolved out of this project mostly and whatever got assigned to me in school theory classes or
write those counterpoint exercises.
Yeah, exactly.
But I also in high school also did know Zubin as a producer, because Zubin was into making beats and doing producing like very early on, and composing in different formats and different contexts in that way. Their experience goes back to high school.
Yeah, and I did a lot of producing, but then also in college, I was a jazz trumpet major, but mm-hmm. became very enamored with the classical composition department and was able to take some really mind-blowing classes, like a composition for performers class, and mm-hmm. Which Willem took also with Stambot?
I was in his theory class, so we got
some
of that.
I don't know, there were some really wonderful composition teachers there who I got to connect with, and I don't know that I actually developed a ton of skills because I came to it. I didn't have the time to really like do that, but it opened my mind a ton. I'm very grateful.
So when, you know, and obviously I'm assuming the answer would be different for each of you, but like when you're writing these things and so many big trucks today, it's just a big truck city. But what was I gonna ask? So
composing his
composing thing. Right. Still on that. I'm gonna forget that I ever said anything about big truck city. That's the dumbest thing I've ever said.
I love it. It's so catchy.
Oh man. So like what? I don't know, it's hard. This is gonna sound so broad. I'm trying to focus it a little bit more. But like what is it like? It's four unique voices, you know, four unique compositional voices, four unique brass playing voices. Where are these compositional like influences coming from? I mean, obviously, like the three, like you three are all like, you know, heavy jazz backgrounds. Willem a little bit more on the classical side. So that's one melding of voices but. Just like more of like a specific, you know, kind of inspirational thing, compositionally. Because I don't know, like when I was listening to your guys' pieces, I was just like, there's something that I can't, like, I was just really curious about like where this was, where these ideas were coming from. And the pieces have these very specific names, you know, kind of a thing. And it's not just like Westerly's Quartet number 3. Like, you know what I mean? I was just really curious about like where all these things were coming from. Like origin points are just like super fascinating to me and how they develop into like a full-blown voice.
There's a lot of answers.
We definitely have
there's so many answers. Like, you can go literally any direction.
I think for me personally as a composer, but also for all four of us as an ensemble, Wayne Horvitz is a huge influence. Mm-hmm. And both his, for me compositionally, his specific style is a big influence to me, but also his general approach and the way that he takes all his favorite types of music and just melds them into more of a compositional style is influential to me, because it sort of showed me, and I think the rest of us, that it it is okay to take whatever styles of music you like and channel them into a project like this. So for me, that was a lot of like American folk music and that kind of stuff.
Yeah, and if there's any specific ensemble reference for us, it's probably his Gravitas Quintet with Sarah Schoenbeck on bassoon, Peggy Lee on cello, and Ron Miles on trumpet. That's kind of, I don't know, I think the sound, especially the initial sounds that we were going for, like really came very referenced to that group. And Ron Miles is huge. A huge influence for Riley and I.
Total fave.
Total.
Well, for anything, any new project or any new kind of thing, I've always heard that you, even before you start to strike out on your own, you try on your heroes. Totally. So to speak, like you're like, oh, I want to try this because this guy did it, and then you know it develops from there, of course. Yeah. You know.
But I think after doing the album of Wayne's music and touring it for a while, I do think that we felt sort of not a crisis of identity, but like we became more interested in our identity, thinking like, okay, we've really explored this kind of sound and this kind of music. Who are we? And I think that's when we started getting much more intentional about making the compositions feel like they were coming from four distinct people.
Mm-hmm.
And I think in the new album, in the new body of music, there's much more contrast, I guess. And I think each of our respective influences come through a lot more clearly.
Yeah, I think for me, the lesson from Wayne Horvitz's music and work in a ton of different genres is that you can take the threads and the things you love about different styles and incorporate them into your own honest personal expression. And I think while all of us come from similar backgrounds geographically, we all have very different and even sometimes conflicting musical interests. And especially in this newest body of music, we really tried to each bring those to the table and throw them into this melting pot and see what running them through the filter of four brass instruments sounds like.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes it doesn't work, but I think that process and that freedom to bring in all these different influences, whether it's American folk music or electronic music or jazz or contemporary classical music or European improvised music or Arabic music, whatever, it's all fair game for exploration. But the unifying thing is that we all play brass instruments.
Yeah.
And I think that's what makes it ours.
You touched briefly on like the improvisational approach to things. Now, when you guys perform, there are no music stands, generally. At least when I saw you, there were no music stands. Everything's memorized. how much of what you do is improvised? Or is it just all like charts that are just in your head?
Magician never reveals.
Fair enough. Okay.
No, it's all it's charts that are in. There's very little improv. As we've developed, there's been less and less improv, but also more focused improv. So we have different ways that we can collectively improvise, or there are some brief moments of solos in a more traditional jazz sense where there are changes, but there's not a lot, but we really found that by getting rid of the music stands and memorizing, it really helped us get the music together, and the rehearsal process of memorizing it revealed a whole lot about the music. And then in terms of feeling like we're on the same page as the audience, as soon as we got rid of music stands, we never wanted to go back to using them.
Yeah,
it was such a revelation. I remember that so specifically.
Yeah.
Like, oh man, this is what's going to make this fun.
So there was a point when you guys were all just like playing off
playing off stands and like more a traditional kind of setup.
Yeah, it was our album release show for the Wayne Horvitz record at Cornelia Street Cafe, where we challenged ourselves to do the whole thing memorized. And we played the whole album front to back. And yeah, it was tough. But not quite as tough as we anticipated, I would say. Like, many of the songs, we realized that we already had most of it down just from how much we played it. And
I would imagine that without you having eyeballs on a piece of paper, that the ears start to pick up more. Or at least in my experience of memorizing things, that's what's happened. Mm-hmm. And a fair amount of what you do is is pretty intricate, you know, with people coming in, moving out, and without a piece of paper, that can be a little bit terrifying because you don't like, you know, I know that I'm always going to be right here, like I know what I'm doing, you know, with intricate music particularly, but you can be more not improvisational note wise, but improvisational with what you're saying. Mm-hmm. And how you shape things, because you're not like referring back to the same thing over and over mm-hmm. again. Did you find that to definitely be the case?
I think we're all just more aware of each other's energy and body language and breathing, mm-hmm. especially when we're not looking at the page. And that has been really transformative in terms of just how we play together and feel each other. And I think that comes across in the music, hopefully. Mm-hmm. And getting off the page was how we discovered that.
Mm. Well, this is like less of a concrete subject, but like when four guys up there playing, you know, you just briefly touched on like the energy of a performing ensemble. Like how do it's difficult to go from place to place and perform the same kind of things every night and because you can kind of get into a rut. I would imagine sometimes just because it's just, you know, it's just how life is sometimes.
That's real.
Like how this is the problem that happens when you don't write questions down sometimes. It's hard to figure out how to phrase them correct, you know, exactly the way I want. Like how does that, like, the, you know, do you guys think about like the flow of energy between musicians and like how you feed off each other? Like how does that work, like, you know, on a night to night basis? It's less of a concrete, like, how do you play this note like this, but it's more of like kind of a amorphous topic to bridge.
That makes sense though. I mean, yeah, when we're on tour, we're all so aware of where each other are. I mean, it's such a four-part relationship. Like, mm-hmm. if someone had a...
It's a love square.
Yeah. It's totally... We are a brass love square.
I think that should be the name of your third album. Yeah. Western Love Square.
The second one isn't titled yet. We could do that.
But I don't know. Like, if someone had a crappy lunch, or mm-hmm. if someone lost $20 at a Dutch Bros, or, you know, if someone had just had a fight with their girlfriend, or someone like didn't get to sleep, whatever, like we're all super aware of that. And when we show up to a venue and we're warming up, it's like, okay, where are we? And before every show, we come together and just breathe kind of in a square of love with each other. And I do think, I don't know, when we perform, I'm so aware of each of the three of these guys and their energies. And I think the really beautiful thing about not having music and playing the same stuff every night and having it so deep in your fingers and in your body that it really becomes this kind of social experience of, this is about four bodies communicating with a bunch of bodies. And I don't know, I think it's, we can very fluidly tell where each other are and like maybe give a little more if someone's feeling a little reserved, or back off if someone wants to pick it up, or slow down if that's what's going on. I don't know, there's a lot of like very sensitive communication of energy there. And this can sound very like
music in general, whatever your stated belief system or non-belief system is, it can be a very spiritual experience. Mm-hmm. Like, especially when you're spending so much time with the same group of people and you know each other so well and you're like coming together as a unified, as one unit. It can be like the idea of energy that we're talking about can be more, it's like a less quantifiable thing.
Totally.
In a more spiritual sense, yeah. if you will.
Yeah, and I think the cool thing about it is it becomes less like we are just expressing what this piece is to mm-hmm. you, and more about like we are expressing how the four of us are right now to you. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, here is us at this moment in this room, and I think that's how I feel.
And I think that should be the end goal for any musician. It's just really hard to get to that point. Where you're so comfortable, like back and forth, that you can do that, you know, as one, four voices coming together as one.
Yeah, but I think that's my answer to what happens if the music gets boring, because it's
that's not what I was.
But like getting stuck in a rut, playing the same stuff every night. I think it becomes less about the music and more about the people.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. I don't think. I don't know. I don't think people talk about like that kind of energy stuff enough, because it can be really like, oh, I don't want to like impugn on someone's like, you know, oh, I'm not comfortable about talking about that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Anyway, just kind of like a less specific question. Like, you guys are all from Seattle. You spent all this time in New York. Like, what are the differences in just like the brass communities that you've found between the two places? Like, was that like a weird experience? Like you mentioned that like when you were like spending a lot of time with all your with friends from Seattle, even while you were still here in New York. Mm-hmm. Like was that like a weird culture shift, or is it just kind of like brass playing?
Well, I think the main thing is that we're not in really any of the brass world in
Mississippi.
We definitely have our different communities. Each of us sort of come from different communities. There is a very strong Seattle community in New York that we love
mm-hmm.
and are really grateful to have here. And then in Seattle, every time we go back, there's a really strong music scene and very welcoming. But in terms of brass, like we...
Got floated
none of us
it.
Really ever...
I have brass bros.
We all have some brass bros.
Willem's our resident. Brass, bro. We're open to it. Anyone listening, if you want to hang out, like get a beer, like I'm around.
You're gluten free. You can't drink beer.
I can get a cider.
Fair enough.
Not to.
I was just curious. Like I don't know.
Well, beyond the brass world, obviously there are big tangible differences
mm-hmm.
in feel between Seattle and New York. And I think all four of us value both places for different reasons, and we really love being in Seattle and in New York for different reasons. You know, New York obviously has so much going on and this great community of people, and Seattle has all this natural beauty and obviously it's our hometown, so it just feels, our relationship with Seattle feels very organic.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know where I'm going with this, but they're both great places.
That was kind of a throwaway question. I'm probably going to cut all of that out because I wasn't happy with my question. So, no worries.
So sick answer.
we definitely had mentors within the brass community in both cities that mm-hmm. have been really instrumental to our development.
I guess a better way to approach that was like, is response to what you do different? Mm-hmm. Like mm-hmm. depending on like whether you're playing on the East Coast or the West Coast. I'm just cause you know, I've been living in New York for probably, it was close to 6 years, but outside of that, I have a very East Coast mentality when it comes to, well, brass music, culture, whatever, you know, and I've spent very little time on the West Coast, so I'm not that familiar with it. So I'm just curious as like what, you know, maybe response wise, if there's just a different kind of energy, like on the opposite side of the country, I guess.
Where are you from originally?
My parents moved a lot. I was a military kid, so like, you know, parts of the South that I never really identified with, mostly. When I moved to New York, it was more of like, oh, this is what I've been wanting to, where I've been wanting to live. This is the kind of culture that I've wanted to be a part of.
Cool.
So that's just kind of like, I'm very East Coast in my thinking.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. That's a toughie. I mean, it's different, but it's also hard
to... And I'm not saying bad versus good versus bad.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. No, not at all. I mean, for one thing, all the cities on the West Coast are all very different from each other. And especially our experience in Seattle is very different from in Portland or Chico or the Bay. So it's... Yeah, I don't know.
But in terms of response to the music, I think it's been pretty similar. Like, we felt... one of the things that's been cool is that whether we're playing in front of a more jazzy New York club audience or playing like we did this house show in Seattle a few weeks ago that was just like young people just out of college, mostly not musicians, hanging out on, it was like a Valentine's party in Seattle, and the response is pretty similar, you know, in terms, and I think that's because of what Zubin was saying about just the social element. And it's especially fun for a crowd, like in random cities we go to when, and in New York you tend to often play for a lot of musicians because the music community here is so strong. But when you get out into these random cities, the people who are coming to your shows may not be musicians at all. But it's cool because they have, I mean, especially with what we do, but in a case like that, no idea what to expect when they see four brass instruments coming. And then when they hear that it's, most of the music is like soft and has all these different textures and it's not what probably their first guess would have been. Like that's the sort of reaction that we often get no matter where we are, and is really fun, and it allows us to really connect with people, whether they're in Seattle or New York or wherever.
Yeah, that's...
And from a really wide range of backgrounds, like, we've played for rock audiences or, like, college kids or in a old folks' home.
That was pretty negative, right?
Yeah, actually. Only from the one lady.
What did she say?
We weren't very good at playing our saxophones.
Yeah, yeah. I think they need to practice more.
But just like,
pretty. All right. I'll practice more.
Very different communities. But if we bring that spirit that Zubin talked about to anybody, we find that most people can feel that energy. And that's what we're trying to bring wherever we go.
Yeah, it's people want to connect with what they're listening to, whether they're, no matter what background they're from. So, yeah, it makes, you know, if you're presenting something that's like, you can, yeah, it goes back to what you're talking about, bringing all these threads into one unique, you know, one unique whole, like, that can speak to college kids in Seattle or... hipster snobs in Portland. Shots fired? No, I'm just kidding. I've never been to Portland, so I can't really say. or like the you know, the music intelligentsia of New York, whatever. Like, if you want to call it that, like, you can really bring it all in. It's a difficult balance to strike.
Yeah, and I mean, one thing that we decided a few years ago was just, we're not going to try to pander towards our audience wherever we are. Because I think the fact that we sometimes find ourselves in front of a chamber music audience or a jazz audience or a rock audience or a folk audience or a totally non-musician audience, it's, you know, at first we were kind of feeling this pull of like, oh, we need to make like the most chamber music-y set we can do, or the most jazzy set we can do. Like, let's get all the solos in, or like, I don't know. Contentious issue is always like what we're gonna wear in those different situations. But I think that we pretty much always come back to doing the same thing, of just like the more that we've developed our band identity, the more we can just kind of be like, this is what we are. This is what we're doing. And trying to be really assured of our own performance and our own energy in these different spaces has become a really important thing to us. And I think like with the goal to draw those people into our thing rather than like try to throw at them what we think that they might want.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
So just a few more things before we kind of wrap up. Writing for each other as specific brass players, what are the challenges that come along with that? Like it's four very different things, very different, you know, strengths. What are the things that
you want us to talk about each other's weaknesses as players?
I don't want to be like, what are people's weaknesses?
Willem plays the lowest notes.
Okay. I'll just
put this. And among the highest.
When I saw you guys at Marvez, after the show, I was like, I was talking to Willem, I was like, did they give you any rest at all? It just seems like you're playing constantly. And we already talked about that a little bit, like about like there's really not that much rest for anyone. Mm-hmm. But Willem's just constantly going like, and then, it sounds exhausting. I was getting like tired like watching him play. I was like, it sounds great. I'm like, God, this is I'm exhausted. Like anyway, but like, you know, writing for each other, like specifically, and we're going to, you know, focus on like the strengths part of that. But like, you know, how long did it take before you really could focus in on like, well, we're going to write like this, like for this, you know, this is going to be like Andy's thing that he's doing for this piece. And this is going to be Riley's thing for this piece. Like, was there a lot of trial and error with like, trying to figure that out?
The very first thing was like, you know, we're all nice guys from Seattle, so we didn't want any like first trumpet versus first trombone, second trumpet, that sort of thing. So in the beginning, we were constantly shifting and trying out different things, and then we just sort of were like, all right, it works best if sort of Riley's on top, Zubin's underneath, then Andy, then Will.
Mm-hmm.
And that was everything came together so much
timbrely,
more.
It just clicks.
I remember there was a time when Andy was playing on a trigger, a big horn with an F attachment, because I think originally we sort of thought, wow, it'd be so cool if we could all just be equally versatile and play all these different roles. And then we got more and more comfortable doing more specific roles, and that's the way it ended up. And I think now we're sort of able to own those strengths more.
Mm-hmm.
And
mess with them.
Right. So that, yeah, it's more effective if there's a moment where it breaks from that.
Yeah. I mean, like we mentioned before, when we started, I was in the middle of a total cold turkey embouchure change, and I couldn't play above like C in the middle of the staff. Like I was deep in it. And I mean, this band was amazing for me because I got to write my own parts, but it was just like, yeah, I can play some really low quiet notes and let me try to make music with that. And it's been like a slow but steady kind of increase in technique for me since then.
Sounds like Maynard Ferguson now, man.
But I don't know, like, so yeah, for me, I mean, we talk about limitations, but my limitations were super extreme when we started. And I was often just doubling Riley's part down an octave. But yeah, I think that people kind of learn to write for me in that way, especially.
And I think another aspect of it is that we very often will collectively arrange pieces. Mm-hmm. So when a piece first comes in, it might be very unorchestrated. It might just be a sketch. And in the process of rehearsal and workshopping a piece, we'll try out all sorts of different configurations, and we might realize, oh, this melody really feels like Zubin's voice or Willem's voice. And we would only know that by experimentation and trial and error.
Yeah.
And every piece, no matter how through composed or completely arranged, always goes through that sort of transformative arranging, democratic, socialist,
Bernie Sanders.
Process. We're not endorsing anybody, but we do operate as democratic socialists.
And that's a huge part of how we arrange music.
Which is funny because Wayne always said that he doesn't believe in democracies in art.
Mm-hmm.
He believes in dictatorships. And then we were like, yeah, cool.
Let's
function differently.
The opposite.
It's true. We definitely just lost our gig at the Republican National Convention. Thanks to this.
Cleveland was our tour.
God.
We're from Seattle, I mean, come on.
So, you know, coming into like late spring and into summer, what do you guys kind of have going on and coming up?
Pretty psyched about stuff.
We are really excited about this residency we're doing in July at a venue in Brooklyn called Tiny Montgomery, which is a back room of this brewery called Three's Brewing in Gowanus.
Oh, I know. I'm familiar with that place.
It's just upstairs.
Every Tuesday in July, we will be presenting our own music and new collaborations with artists from a variety of disciplines and other bands, and it's going to be a really fun month. Mm-hmm. After that, we're playing at the Newport Jazz Festival at the end of July, and then our record will be coming out sometime in September, October, followed by lots of shows. So
yeah.
We're doing a little West Coast run at the end of August, too.
Mm-hmm.
Idlewild Jazz Fest and a couple others.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, guys, thanks so much for doing this. It's been a real pleasure for me. Definitely looking forward to the new album.
Cool.
Thank you, Dan.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.